Go ahead. Start your recording.
All right. And with that, hey, Paul, welcome back to the Survival Podcast, man. It's good to actually be with you here in Montana.
Right, in Dayton. We're both shacked up at the same place with Bill here and hanging out with Sep, just taking it easy. You know, oh, that's right, you weren't here that night when Sep came over for dinner.
Yeah, jerk. You guys are both jerks, man, because, like, I saw that picture and I thought, like, oh, this is what Sep does. He comes and hangs out at Bill's place. And, like, I'll be up here for, like, a week hanging with Sep. And I get to hang with Seb at the seminar, but he has not returned to the roost here.
You know, the important thing to point out is Seb loves me more than he loves you.
I surmise that, but I just think that's because you're like, you've met him first, and he knows what you do, and he doesn't really know what I do yet, so we'll see. Maybe one day I'll become the favorite child, but for now, you have the honor.
So I was visiting with the interpreters, and they were saying that on the plane over, he was talking about me, and then he told me that he thought I was the number one permaculture guy in the United States, and he says he'll say that on any kind of recording device, but of course, he's so swamped, it's like, I don't know if I'll ever get to record anything with him again.
Yeah.
We'll see. It's like this ongoing day, and day after day after day, and you just really don't get time with him.
Well, he wants you to go to Russia, so maybe you could get him to say it in Russian.
Yeah, maybe as we're sitting on the plane next to each other, we can like, okay, how about now?
Yeah.
Now good?
So, I mean, I wanted to kind of chat with you about your interpretations of some of the things we've seen, your thoughts, some of the things that we've seen so far. So what's like one of the things out of this week so far that kind of really sticks out to you?
That I got sick.
I mean about
a substance that people listening to this might care about.
No one cares that you were sick except me. I care, but lots of people out there don't care.
You don't care. Just say that, man. All right. About 95% of it I already know. I mean, either from reading his books or more dominantly from 3 years ago. But there have been a couple of little tidbits, and there's also been a couple of times where it's like I know what he means to say, but the message that comes through the interpreter, I feel like it's very vague, and I feel like people get the wrong. So then I know there have been a couple of times when I, you know, waved my hand up and I said, I want to ask a very exact question to try and nail him down. And so, like, for example, the tomato one. Do you remember the tomato question? And I did it because he was saying, oh, transplant. Here's how you transplant stuff and everything.
Sure.
So then it's like he ended up talking about transplant. So I'm thinking, okay, people are getting the wrong idea. They think that Sep is, like, keen on transplanting. And so I said, okay, Sep, here's the deal. Here's what I've been telling people, and I've been telling people that the number one thing to do is let the plants reseed themselves. Number two, direct seed. And number three, avoid transplanting whenever possible.
Number four, do it when there's no other choice.
Yeah, so, and then he verified that. He just said, yes, that's it. That's correct. Okay. And it's like, but then after 20 minutes of him talking about transplanting, that was never clear.
Yep.
So I felt that was an important one to convey.
And I think that there's definitely that kind of like a language barrier, and sometimes I wonder if we ask a question and then we either get beat up by the master or we don't really get an answer. If it's not really the master not explaining it, but the translator not quite pulling off the translation.
Right. I mean, I kind of wonder about that because Sep kind of gives the translator a moment to translate, and if he can't get it through, he's moving forward.
Yeah, he's going to talk about something.
He's got his pace, and he's not going to be slowed down by a translator. And you can kind of see once in a while the translators are like, what's the word for? And it's like, too late. And whatever that was, it's gone.
You know, one of the things that blew me away, a question you asked. You asked, like, how much should, you know, Katarina be able to make on the farm? She's got, like, what, 90 or 100 acres or something like that. And you said, do you think that she should be able to make, let's say, at least $500,000? And most farmers with 90 acres aren't making crap near that. And his response was, I would be very disappointed if I only made $500,000 here.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I spent a lot of time crafting that question, you know, and in fact, I think I asked the question originally wrong, and I said, how much? And then I kind of like at some point after hearing 10 minutes worth, I said, okay, I want to ask, do you think that a student of Sep Holzer could, on this piece of land, which is 94 acres, do you think that they could earn $500,000 a year? And I think his response was something along the lines of, at least, at least that much.
And he said it would be a failure. right? That's like, you know,
like half a million would be lame.
Well, what he actually said was that his land, the Kermadov,
yeah,
right? That they spent, they pay almost that much in taxes.
Oh, they paid, they paid that much in taxes. Right, right.
So clearly, if you're paying a half a million in taxes, you're making more than that. I think his operation is similar in land size, isn't it? It's like
he's got about 120 acres or so.
Acres, yeah, yeah, and very similar climate.
Right.
Very
right.
So I think he's like he's in his element here as far as the climate goes.
Right, right. We are at almost exactly the same latitude. And in fact, here in Dayton, Montana, we're at about almost exactly the same elevation.
Really? I thought he was higher, but...
No, if we were in Missoula, which
yeah.
is lower than here,
yeah.
then yeah,
it
would be higher than Missoula.
But what's really cool here is we've got this huge lake, and as Bill told us, this actually creates a microclimate here, and this is Zone 5 where most of the rest of Montana is Zone 4.
Welcome
That's
to the
cool.
Welcome to the banana belt of Montana.
The banana belt of Montana, full of lake trout, huckleberries, and really good microbrew beers.
Yeah, everything here is about the huckleberry. Although here at Flathead Lake, it's also about the Flathead cherry, because in most of Montana, it's difficult to grow cherries. But all around the lake, you see cherry orchards everywhere.
Well, and they're growing wild too. We have a whole bunch of old growth ones that are just growing all over the back of Bill's property here, so that's kind of cool. So,
while Flathead cherries are indeed delicious, they don't hold a candle to huckleberries.
Yes.
And so,
well, you had huckleberry buffalo stick yesterday that I got.
I thought that was really good.
That was awesome.
Good. Yeah,
that was awesome.
So you've been hitting all the huckleberry fun things?
Huckleberry buffalo sticks, huckleberry beer, but I have not yet had a huckleberry shake because it's highly non-paleo. But Bill keeps telling me, like, go get one for Dorothy and just try it. And then I know if I try it, I'm going to eat the whole damn thing and ruin all...
You're going to feel shitty for like 2 or 3 days.
Correct.
You might as well have some huckleberry taffy. The huckleberry pretzels are really good.
What about huckleberry pie? I mean, I know that would be like in a Paul Wheaton sweet spot, wouldn't it?
They typically serve that only seasonally, but I got to tell you that I managed to score a bag of frozen huckleberries from somebody and gave them to a pie master and was able to consume huckleberry pie, and it was awesome and fantastic. Because somehow when the huckleberries were on late this last year, and so I went high and far, and I could not get a huckleberry pie to save my life. And then, you know, and really the solution is, well, go out and pick some damn huckleberries.
Well, yeah.
But then there's that step of, like, then you take the huckleberries and convert them into the lusciousness of pie. But I have not been pie deficient. There have been many, many people who have made sure that I have ample pie. Oh, and then we got invited out to something a couple of nights ago, and Scout made two pies because I was coming over. Livia is her name, from Portland, and she's been here for all of the PDC, and she's here for all of the SEP stuff, and she made an apple pie, and she made a mixed berry pie, which did include huckleberries.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was, yeah, and I believe I ate them while you were sitting on the couch there and enjoyed a piece of each, but I can't remember, was Jack here that day I was enjoying that pie?
You admitted eating apple pie, but you'd never said anything about the huckleberry pie. So it could have been that you were hiding your huckleberry.
I'm glad to tell you about the mixed berry pie after I ate it.
Okay.
Because as was pointed out, as I was consuming it, that if I shared any of it, I would have less.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get back on to the
topic. Oh, right. You know, that was an important topic.
Yeah,
we should always talk about pie in every show.
Yeah.
All right. So then the $500,000 thing, the next one was is on the day that I was sick. I mean, there was one day that I missed because I was sick, and I've been going back, and I've been trying to take it easy and get better, but I only missed one day, and the rest of the day I'm kind of a vegetable there, but the rest of the time. But there's on the one day that I missed, you guys were telling me the story of, like, oh, you missed the most awesome and amazing thing in the world. And so tell me the story again, Jack.
Yeah, it was a really pissed off Austrian tearing apart a tree. So Katarina or one of her people went down to a local market here and got, you know, typical grafted fruit trees like you buy. And I don't think that alone was really a big problem. Seth was like, it's not the best choice, but it's okay. It was the trees themselves. And they were packed in sawdust. So he picks it up, and God, I wish he spoke German, because I know something was lost in translation of the words, but the actions were absolutely clear. So he starts snapping at it first, and he's pointing at the picture on the bag, and he's basically, and the one word I know out of all the German he's saying is kaputt for dead and supermarket, because supermarket's remarkably similar, right? So I know he's saying the supermarket tree is kaputt, and he's snapping at about it, and then he opens it up, and then he holds the bag up, and he shows the picture, and he's like, you see the fruit on the picture. People look at this and go, oh, it's good fruit because it says so on the picture. And basically, he was using a version of your thing. That's just marketing. So then he takes the sawdust out. He shows the sawdust is moist. The sawdust is actually very, very moist. But the tree is dead. And he proves that by he starts at the very tips, and he's snapping the tips off. Where you're going, well, sometimes the tips die, and you bring it back. But then he's like, just smashing the tree, and he's getting angrier and angrier, and he's calling it a fraud, and basically the people that did it should be beaten and burned at the stake or something. He was very upset, and when he threw it in the air, it looked like dust, and he's like, you could make a fire with it. This is kindling. And then he explained that the sawdust as a medium for the fruit tree roots will literally suck the moisture out of the tree instead of providing it to the tree, and you should never, ever, 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 ever buy a supermarket tree packed in sawdust. And if you do, you're basically a brain-dead idiot, and don't do that ever again. And he made a really good case for it. Of course, we put all the trees in the truck, and they went back. My suggestion, because some people were videoing this, is when you go back to the store, take somebody's smartphone, and show Step snapping out, and say, if you don't give me a refund, this man's coming here, and he's going to stand in front of your store and smash your trees. And I think she got a refund, but it was actually a good education, because he looked at them a little bit differently, because some of them weren't as bad as the one he picked, but he was showing you how you could, like, basically feel the bark, and just by feeling the bark, you could tell that it wasn't dead yet, but a lot of damage had been done. And I know this, I'll never buy a tree packed in sawdust again, just because he might find out and be mad at me.
Seth will track you down. But Seth, I mean, knows.
The upshot was the best thing to do would be dig up local well-started trees that are already well-started, if you're going to bring them into a new environment, or grow trees from seed, or get really well-developed, if you're going to use rafted varieties, really well-developed, well-cared-for trees that haven't been in a container too long. And he actually went into a big talk, I think you were there for this, about, you know, if they're in the container too long, the roots will circle.
Oh, yeah.
And then they don't go out deep. But he actually left something out I think it's really important that people know about. It's called circling and girdling root syndrome.
Right.
Where the roots will circle the tree, and the tree might look happy for 5 years, and eventually the trunk of the tree will grow into the root, and it'll do the same thing as if you wrapped a wire around it. I'm sure he knows that, but he didn't mention it.
Yeah. I mean, now we're talking about stuff that's like standard master gardener knowledge.
Yeah.
Versus, I mean, that's kind of like another topic that we wanted to kind of talk about, is that there have been like about one question out of four or five. It's like, really? Do we have to ask that question? Because, I mean, here we've got Seth Holzer here. Can we talk about something a little? Read the book.
Well, yep. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it. If you're going to a PDC or a Master Gardener class or a basic workshop, fine. You want to show up not knowing shit, fine. You're there to learn, fine. When you go to see Seth Holzer, or I put other people in this, like Jeff Lawton or Bill Mollison, read their books, watch their videos, know their basics, because I feel like some of the people here are coming to Einstein and saying, please teach me to do long division. And he's like, no, right? It's ironic, they're both German.
No,
right?
He's doing it. Yeah. He's answering
he's
their
answering
question, but he's
it.
Rolling his eyes and getting pissed.
You can tell he's not happy to be asked, how do I, you know, multiply 40 by 3 and show my work, right? Because he's here with this project that's so beyond the scope of even what I thought it was. And I feel like you, like most of the things he's talking about, I already know because it's so well documented in his work. Seeing the design be developed, that's what I'm learning from. And I think a lot of people are struggling with that because they're back on page one, you know, of the PDC instead of on the advanced stuff that he's already documented. And he's saying, in my book, as though I thought that you people that would come here and pay lots of money to see me would have maybe invested $30 in the book first. Right? You know? And I think that it's not just permaculture. It's anything you're going that's in advanced training and you've got an advanced teacher that's documented their work, it would behoove you to at least have a basic understanding of their base work before you show up, because then you're like, you're holding the rest of the class back, you know, and you're also irritating the teacher.
Well, and I kind of feel like, you know, Sepp is now, you know, in this space where he kind of figures that what a bunch of fucking idiots, and it's like, you know, so now I've got to teach at this much lower level, and because these guys just don't have what it takes to be able to understand the more advanced stuff.
But there's a lot of us going, no, give me, but he doesn't hear us because they keep talking. And I think we can Google culture them.
Yeah.
If we build another bed with all of the, no, we shouldn't do that. I'm kidding.
Ah, okay. Not a bad, it's something to think about.
Yeah. Can you build a Google culture with human beings? You know, I mean, no.
Bone sauce. I think bone sauce. Yeah.
We
can do that. Yeah. All right. You know, on the point of you were saying about where to get your stuff, there's a guy, it turns out to be in Dayton, like just a mile away, has this acre of just packed to the gills of all kinds of stuff. And so we're currently getting all kinds of raspberries from his land, all kinds of stuff. And so I went over there. Somebody said, you got to go see it. And I was like feeling a little low, a little sick still. And so, but I'm going to go make some video. I'm going to go, you know, take it easy. It's a sunny, warm day.
Yep.
This guy is just donating tons of little baby fruit trees and all kinds of plants and all kinds of stuff to be transplanted.
Thousands and thousands of dollars if you went to buy this stuff, and he's giving it away.
Right, because he's just cool.
He's cool, and I think there's two things that he's blown away by. One, he came over and saw the size of the project, and he went, holy crap, I can't believe this. But two, this is what a lot of people, I haven't got to talk to him yet, but a lot of these people that are here have told me, there's a lot of people here that are in their early 20s, and he is blown away that young people are actually doing this stuff. This guy's a guy that, you know, came back from Vietnam, he's been living on like $6,000 a year on his little place down there by the lake, and he's been growing his own food, and he felt like he's all alone. And like seeing this makes him realize, like, this is a movement. This is a real movement. And young people, not just a bunch of old farts like us, but young people are actively involved in doing this stuff.
These are my peeps.
Yeah. And he's like 70 some odd years old. And I think for him, it's like he was just floored that there's, you know, 22, 23, 24 year old kids taking time out of their life to come here and learn this, participate, and do this. And that was really like almost like a manifestation. Because Katarina's going, oh my god, I didn't know I was going to get like these giant, long, huge hoogle beds. What am I going to plant it all? And then like, this guy's there and they're getting a little bit of stuff. When he sees, he's like, yeah, I'll just fill you up. And I mean, like, that's like really not something you expect to happen. Don't plan on that. But when it happens, there's something really special kind of going on there.
So I got two points to convey from my trip over there. And one point is that he had a bunch of apple trees there that he started from seed. And he says, yeah, I'm eating this really delicious apple. And I'm thinking, man, this is good. I want some more of these. And so he just shoves the seeds in the ground. Up pops a tree. And now he eats those apples. And it's like not just exactly the same as the parent, of course. Like, no one's exactly the same as their mom.
Correct.
But it's still a very delicious apple, and he's been very happy. And he's got like 7 or 8 different apple trees on his land that were started from seed. And I think most of them, the fruit is either excellent or good. And he said there's one or two where the quality was poor or awful. And then he's like, oh, I'll just take it out. You know, the ones that are awful, I'll just hack them out and something else.
I'll grow something
there.
And I mean, I also think he's like really jazzed about, like, he's giving away all these raspberry canes, and he's like, but there's still some left, and we'll just grow back. So I can give them away to you, and I really haven't done anything from my side because they're just going to come back.
Yeah. The other point is, it has to do with dumb questions. And so I was there, I wasn't feeling really good, and the wind's blowing hard, and so this young fellow's there, and he asks me the question. He's like, okay, hey, Paul, suppose I've got this drain field. I've got a septic tank with a drain field, and the drain field is immense. It's really, really huge.
Yes.
And, of course, everything's flat over there. There's just some, you know, weeds and grass growing there and everything. And he says, I want to build a full step-sized hugelkultur bed, 6 feet, 6.5 feet, 7 feet tall on this drain field.
Yeah.
And I said, no, you don't want to do that because the drain field has to be 18 inches from the surface. So it's buried at just the right level.
Correct.
And his response was, yeah, I don't believe that.
Well, why do you ask you the question? I mean, that's, you know, the, if you're not willing to accept the answer, why do you ask the question?
Well, and that was, you know, I was a little surprised myself. So then Dale was standing right there, and Dale says, Paul is right. So then we proceeded to explain about how you needed to get aerobic activity and how the bacteria...
Like what actually it does.
So we're explaining it to him, and he's like, still doesn't believe it. And then George is there, and then George says Paul is right, and then think of it this way. Still doesn't believe it. Then today, he asks the question of Sep, and Sep's like, no, don't even use a drain field like that.
Yeah.
You need to use something that's basically a gray water system type of thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, won't even address the question.
Yeah, like,
the whole idea of having a drain field is so wrong.
Yeah. Nine.
Yeah.
Right?
And so it's like, I'm just thinking like, because that was in hindsight, because the thing is, because the wind was blowing, I like really wore out my throat. And the throat's the thing that's killing me, is just being sick. And I'm just kind of thinking, man, can we just, you know, yeah. Why don't you believe me? Why did you ask me the question if you're not going to believe me?
Sure.
So I should have just left it at that. Well, fine then. You don't believe me. That's cool, man. Just don't believe me.
But you're trying to help him.
I tried.
Yeah,
and
that always sucks.
I need to stop helping people.
You need to help willing people. You can't help.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
I call it dragging people across the finish line. I don't do that. You know?
I should help people who trust my stuff. They think Paul has a lot of authority and experience, I'm going to trust what Paul said.
And I'm sure, like me, you don't mind being questioned as a teacher, but when you're asked a flat question, you give a flat answer to simply say, no, I don't believe it. You know, that's kind of like, why then did you bother?
Yeah.
It's not something that concrete. I mean, you're clearly right because that's how it works.
All right, last point, then we got to get back to what's going on. The last note I've got here, just for now, because my big notes are there. I left them there. The size of the Hugo culture bed.
You could tell somebody a meter and a half. You could know what a meter and a half looks like until you walk in between them. You don't really get the size and the angle. The steep 70-degree angles is pretty impressive. And then the other thing I think you can't really understand till you, and it's not one, right? It's multiples in the way they're curved and bent around each other. It's this like outdoor living room effect. Like when you walk through there, you feel it, like when they first built them, they were just as big and they were done, but it was all muddy and mucky and nasty and a couple days of planting and putting trellises on them and making them start to dry out and look better and you can walk without walking in the muck. And now you feel like you're walking into something special. And my thought is, what's it going to be like in 6 months when all of that stuff goes in? You know, and it's
I'll pop up and take pictures.
Yeah, and it's framed from the house. Like he's done it so that Katarina's house is kind of shielded from the road and they kind of close off at the end, but from her house you're looking into it with this beautiful lake and these other high beds on the other side of the lake, and you can't, I mean, I'll take pictures, I'll post stuff when I get back, but I don't think a person is really going to comprehend the size and the scope of the project without standing in the middle of it. And it makes a lot of the stuff you read in his book make so much more sense. And you understand why when you're building your little 3-foot Hugo beds at home, it's not that they don't work, but they're not going to do what his do. So work is a relative term, right? If I can put my tomatoes and peppers and stuff in there and I can water one time through the entire summer, it's clearly worked. But it hasn't done what Sep Holzer does.
One of the Traco operators talked to me before Sep arrived and was asking me what it would be like, and I said, okay, I've seen Sep with Traco operators before, and if you get it just slightly wrong, he will get livid pissed.
Yes.
And so there's really two things that you need to make sure that you do, and in order, and because I've also seen him fall in love with Traco operators, and so here's the big secret. One, you got to make the sides of the Hugo culture beds really steep.
Correct.
Two, you got to get it really tall.
Yeah.
So basically, you're going to prove your expertise at being able to stack wood and dirt really tall and thin.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you can do that, then he's going to... Because most of them, they start off making them, like, too thick at the bottom, and the slopes are too shallow. But no, this is Hugo culture. This is not building a dam. Building a dam, you need a shallow slope. So it's like, if you can do that, he will think you are the most supreme expert driver there is, and then he'll be your buddy.
Which really is hard to do. It's hard for the operator to allow themselves to do, but it's really not difficult. If you can run up a Traco, you can build the Hugo bed properly, but I think a lot of them, they're probably thinking, I don't know why the hell I'm making this big pointed thing, And when you first start building them, they kind of look ugly. And when there's like 10 of them together and they're all incorporated, you go, this is amazing. And that place he built this stuff in, when people started showing up there, it was a swamp. And now there's this big open water feature, and there's this giant, only way I can describe it is a giant series of outdoor rooms. And it's creating all these microclimates. And the ones he's building there, actually, I think they're a little bit bigger than a meter and a half. He said they're perfect for you to use.
They're a little taller than me. I'm 2 meters tall. I'm almost two meters tall.
Yeah.
So these are, but then the other side is that during part of the planning, the top will be smushed down a little bit.
Okay.
But and then I also think that they're going to, as they rot a little bit, they should get a little shorter as the insides rot a little bit. But Seth Holzer told me when I was driving over here with him when he's coming over for dinner. So this is before you arrived.
Yes.
I mentioned something about that, and he's like, no, if your hugelkultur beds get shorter because it's the decomposition inside, you've built it wrong.
And he told you you're using too much wood, didn't he?
He did. Too much wood. When he was here, I showed him my hugelkultur article, and he looked at that first picture, and he says, too much wood.
Wow.
But, you know, when you look at the picture, too, it is kind of like, how are you ever going to get your wood stacked that neatly inside?
True.
And so, but the idea is, when the picture was made, the idea was to show that there's soil touching all the wood and that there's a lot of wood on the inside and then a thick layer of soil on the outside.
Wow.
So, I agree. He's right. Too much wood.
Now,
good luck getting that much wood in a hugelkultur bed.
Now, what I wish everybody in my audience that keeps going, can I use ash? Can I use this? Can I use that? I wish they could be here because basically the stuff that was there, they smashed it down, piled it up, and used it. Like, they used everything. It was none of this, like, well, that wood's really not suitable, and this is a piece of oak, or that's a piece of ash, or this is going to decompose too quickly. It was like a polyculture hugelkultur. It was like every tree that was there, if it's there, it's going in the bed. And they just did it. And he didn't worry about it. I didn't see him up, like going, oh, I can't use this piece of tree, or this one's too fat, or this one's too skinny. He just basically knew how big he wanted the pile to be, and he just did it. And I think that's a big lesson for people in not just hugelkultur, but all the permaculture stuff. Follow your gut. Do it. If it doesn't work, observe, interact, and change it the next time. You're not buying whole life insurance when you plant a bed. You can change it later if you're not happy with the results.
Right. So then another interesting thing that you mentioned, you wanted me to put on the list here, is trees and nails.
Yeah. I built like a micro hugel bed, I think culture would call it, because it was only about maybe a meter high. But I did the steep banks, and I'm starting to have erosion issues, right? So how do you fix that? Well, you cut down a bunch of trees and you make nails, as he calls them, which are basically like a forked stick that are like a tent peg, right?
Yeah, a tent stick is what
I
think.
And you stack your trees on there and then you peg them into the side of the hugel bed. You plant even more stuff in there. And then you have like a natural trellis, plus you control your erosion, you mulch over top of it. And I think that is going to help a lot of people, especially with poor quality soils like I have. Because here he said, you don't really have to do it. It would be a good idea. But in places where you have poor quality soils and this erosion is a problem, this will stop it cold. And it'll make this wonderful blanket. And if you plant any kind of vining crop low, it'll go straight up and it makes a trellis. And it's really awesome. And it's really simple to do. I mean, you harvest some trees and, you turn them into a resource.
All right. We good? We got anything else?
No, except that I would reiterate, if you ever get a chance like this to take it, even though I feel like you and I feel like I've known a lot of what's been said, it was worth every bit of the trip up here because until I saw it, I really couldn't conceive of it. Being a big student of Jeff Lawton's, I could walk out on that property before anything was done, and I could go, Jeff Lawton would have, and boom, 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 and the swales and how they would connect. If I would have walked out there last week, and you said, what would Seth Holzer do? I really wouldn't have known. Now I do.
He's. You know what? I had some good ideas about what he's going to do, and I thought I had it pretty well pegged.
You've been through it before.
Well, I've been through it before, and so I've studied his stuff a long time, and he and I have done a lot of talking in the past, and so it's like I feel like I. Plus, the other thing is, in his mind, I'm the number one permaculture guy in the USA. So, I went on the land thinking, okay, I know what he's going to do.
Yeah.
I can predict very well what he's going to do. I know what's going to happen, and it turns out that I was wrong, and I would not. I would not have had the nads to try and build as big of a lake as he's building.
Yeah.
He's, and it's like...
you're talking about the lake that they just started on yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're over there standing in the mud today. I would not have tried something that large. And he's, but his mission is he's trying to build something that's a lake as opposed to a pond. It's probably going to be something on the order of like 2 or 3 acres.
Yes.
And he wants to be very, very, very deep. And his purpose is that he wants to make it so that the water surface in the wintertime never freezes because it's so deep. And what happens is that the water at the bottom will be 54 degrees because that's the temperature when it's that low. When the surface is like freezing, then the water starts to circulate.
Correct.
Inside of the body of water.
And you'll get ice, but you will not get ice across the entirety of the lake.
Right.
Always the ice-free zones is what
ice
going for.
Dominantly around the edges, you'll have ice. And so then it's throwing off this 54-degree heat, which then heats the plants around it. So you kind of have created a pretty intense microclimate.
Absolutely.
And so you can now do more interesting things, and so that's kind of what he's shooting for. He did get all the okie dokies and permissions from the local government in order to be able to do this, so he's doing it.
Yeah.
I just would not have been as bold. I would have gone for smaller stuff, but he's going to have a bigger impact.
And I think the last thing we should finish up with is, even though you and I are blown away by the scale, he's not doing what he would have done if it was his land. He would have gone so much bigger. The excavator is too small. There's a 20-ton excavator. Too small. 30-ton excavator. It's better, but imagine if it was twice as big. And
the morning that the excavator showed up, I said, these are way too small. Seb is going to be pissed. And sure enough, he got there, and he was. He was like, and throughout the stuff, every day he kind of says, these are so ridiculously small.
Yeah.
What do you think we're going to do? Oh, that was a thing. That was an interesting thing. We had somebody there who became really upset at the idea that a tree was being taken out.
Oh, yes.
And it's like, oh, we're going to build a pond here. What the hell did you think was going to happen to the tree that's out in the middle where the pond is going?
Well, what I loved was his response when he finally addressed that later on in the day. He said, look at how sick this land is. Look how many animals are suffering. Look how the land is suffering. And you sometimes, basically, I'm putting my words into it now, but what I took away from it was, if you're my patient and I'm your doctor, you have gangrene, I have to cut the gangrene off.
Yeah.
But then imagine what will happen once I heal it, and then you can go forward. And it was really cool.
He's building a jungle there. It's going to be a jungle where it was just like this dried up grass before.
Yeah, this little clump of crap trees that you could literally push over, yourself, honestly.
Sepp Holzer has an intense romance with nature, and Sepp and nature are creating symphonies in seed and soil. And this is part of it. Nature is grooving on what he's doing. Now, it doesn't look good right now, but it's like, it is a masterpiece, and it will be, he is the artist, and we will see what is in his brain in the years to come, and it will be magnificent. I'm certain of it.
Well, my thing is, I think this will be the first thing like this ever done in the United States, and I think people will come here to see it in mass, and then my hope is that will create like an infection where other people will do this, because what I'm seeing here is not really designed for me to do on my 5 acres or 20 acres. You could do it maybe on 20, but this is designed for the farmer. This is designed for somebody that wants to make a living with this. This is somebody who wants to create a brand, and that's how he thinks. He was telling Katarina, I think I would have a logo, I would have a brand, I would have a name, and I would market the heck out of this, and this could be your livelihood here.
Right.
And I think it can, and I think that it'll inspire many people to do that, and I will probably come back up here just to see what it looks like a year from now.
Well, I think Sepp's passion for this path is immense, and I think Katarina's passion is a different flavor.
Yeah.
So what we're going to end up seeing is we're going to see not a full-scale sepification.
Correct.
But you're going to see a taste of sep.
And a beautiful test bed. An absolutely artistic, beautiful test bed that will prove it works. And I think that's what other people need to see. They don't need to just see like a picture of it. They need to see it function. And once you see something work, you think, oh, well, I can do that. Yeah. And a person that comes out there and sees like 10% of her land done this way and realizes she's getting more production off that than the entirety of their whole, realizes, so I can go do this on all my land. And there's a learning curve, but I think that I think we're on the right track now, and I'm grateful he came here and did this.
If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about the mighty, the glorious, the amazing Sepp Holzer, homesteading and permaculture all the time.